one of whom isn't here. We have a new council member, Representative Don Wells, who is took Tom's 81st district seat. So Tom is our Senate representative, and Don Wells, who is from Aiken, is our House representative. The other two people I want you to meet are Trish German, right there, and Jennifer Satherwaite, right here. They are, it takes two people to replace Rebecca, apparently. Anyway, Rebecca has gone upstairs to the Budget and Control Office, and they are filling in our energy office liaison. So we're very glad that you guys are here, and we appreciate the help very much. Just a reminder, if you want to make a public comment, sign up on the sheet outside, which I didn't even know was out there last time, and they'll bring that to me at the end of the meeting. If you have your public comments written, give them to either Trish or Jennifer, or email them to her to make sure that we capture your comments fairly accurately. So the first thing we need to do is approve two sets of minutes, because I said at the December meeting that I would send out the September minutes for approval, and I completely forgot. Don, welcome.
Well, thank you.
I would like y'all to meet our new council member. This is Representative Don Wells. Thanks for coming.
Good to see you.
And Tom just sent word up the Senate is still in session, but he will be here when Senate lets out, so we'll have a pretty full House. So council members, we have to vote on two sets of minutes, September's and December's. So is there any discussion on either one of these? Motion?
So moved.
Passed?
Second.
Ayes?
Aye.
Got it. Okay, we're up to date. Thank y'all very much. Let me just tell you a little bit about what we've done since the last meeting. Thanks to Steve and Terry Mikulski, I got to go to PC Summers 2 and 3, which is very interesting, and in the simulator, which I have wanted for years to get into, which I said it was on my bucket list. So I appreciate that very much. Worked out well. It's a very interesting site. If y'all get a chance to go to either that one or the Vogel site, I would suggest that you go. Very interesting. Earlier this week, I attended a public meeting at the Savannah River site to talk about the F-tank farm tanks 5 and 6 tank closure module, which SRS hopes to close these two tanks by the end of the year. This was their closure plan. They are accepting comments, or DHEC is accepting comments on DOE's closure module until the end of March, I think. I have, and I can give you the website if you want to comment. And DOE has also issued the H tank farm. We're moving from F tank farm to H tank farm. 3116 determination for draft is out for comment. So the council will be sending those comments in before the 1st of May. And I think that's it, unless anybody else wants to say anything. Don, do you want to say anything? Anything else? Okay. First on the agenda, Mr. Byrne. Who's going to talk about, give us an update on scan on BC Summer.
All right, well, thank you. It's been an eventful time period since the last time that I presented to this council, which looking back at my notes, it's been quite some time ago now. What you see on the picture on the wall is the site as it looked in roughly October of last year. But you can see some things that are pretty well defined now. Unit 2 excavation, the Unit 3 excavation, the heavy lift derrick, which is right in between the two excavations, our module assembly building, which is about 120 feet tall, and about the size of a football field inside. You can see the area near the bottom of the picture where we are assembling the rings of the containment vessel, and we'll look a little bit more closely at those in a few minutes. And then near the top is there where the forced draft low-profile cooling tower is going to go. So what's going on at the site? Well, we're using the derrick. We are training on the simulators. We have two AP1000 simulators at the site now. We have completed the containment vessel lower bowl. As I said, we'll look at that in a little more detail in a minute. We are welding the Unit 2 containment vessel ring sections, and those will sit on top of the lower bow. They get stacked on top and welded. The switchyard is now energized. We are receiving submodules for the first big module placement. That first big module is a large portion of the auxiliary building, including a spent fuel pool, and it's called CA-20. We are erecting the cooling towers. We are assembling the condensers. We poured about 30,000 cubic yards of concrete for each unit. The Unit 2 turbine building base mat was completed. We are placing the mud mat for Unit 3, and we completed the first nuclear concrete pour for Unit number 2, which is a big milestone for us. What's coming up after this should read 2013 milestones. In the second quarter, we're going to set a module called CR-10, and CR-10 is what will hold the containment vessel. So the lower bowl of the containment vessel will sit into CR-10. We're going to continue welding of module subsections in our module assembly building, and we'll be installing the waterproof membrane for Unit number 3. And then the third and fourth quarters, we'll set the Unit 2 containment vessel, and then we'll set the CA-20 module, which I talked about a few minutes ago, and we'll pour the base mat for Unit number 3. We did get our permit for the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System for the site, another good milestone. We also received accreditation for our operator training programs. So in the nuclear world, you have to have accredited training programs, and this was Vogel's project and our project were the first new members of that National Nuclear Academy Training Council. Of course, you may be aware that Shaw, who was our constructor, was acquired by Chicago Bridge and Iron, or CB&I. That closed in mid-February. And as a prerequisite to that deal, Shaw, who was a 20 or 25% owner in Westinghouse, put that back to Toshiba, so Toshiba is now an 87% owner of Westinghouse. Westinghouse, who is our designer, has a new CEO, a gentleman named Danny Roderick. We did also start our initial licensed operator training class, so even though we won't be online till 17 and 18, we need to start the operator license classes now. And then Duke is still involved with Santee Cooper on an ownership stake. So this is Santee Cooper wanting to sell some portion of their 45% to somebody else, and they're currently still negotiating with Duke. These are a couple of shots of the Unit 2 nuclear island. That just means the area where the nuclear components will go. The top left is from March of 2012. So that was before we received our license. So that was just forming. Top right, that's dental concrete, and that's exactly what it sounds like. You're filling in all the cavities and the holes and the gaps and the core bores and those kind of things. On top of the dental concrete, then you'll level the site, so you'll pour a leveling concrete. And bottom left is, on top of that leveling concrete, you'll pour a mud mat. And so you can see the mud mat in the foreground, and then the vapor barrier goes on top of the lower mud mat, and you can see the vapor barrier in the background. And then when all of that is complete, you put the reinforcing bar for the nuclear island on top of that upper mud mat, and you can see some of that reinforcing bar cage on the bottom right. This is a close-up of the nuclear island base mat rebar. So what we're looking at here is the south side of that, and that where the containment vessel goes is going to be a circular section, which is kind of in the middle. And there is said containment section. So the containment vessel will sit inside of there, and then you'll build the shield building around it. And then north side, generally where the battery rooms go, this is the base mat for the north side. So all of these components together would make up the base mat. Now, this is the start of our first nuclear concrete pour. You can see a lot of articulating arms from concrete pumper trucks there. We actually had four concrete pumper trucks. You can see the concrete pumper there, and then a concrete truck, and that's where the term the whole nine yards comes from, is in general those concrete trucks are equipped to handle about 9 yards of concrete. You can see where the containment vessel area is, and you can see that it's concreted now. and we poured for 50-plus consecutive hours, so it was around the clock from a Saturday morning to Monday afternoon. Sorry, Monday morning. And here we're nearing completion. The south end has been poured. The area where the containment vessel will go has been poured, and they're just finishing up pouring on the north end. And you can see where the turbine building is behind it, and you can see that we've already started to go vertical on the turbine building. And this is Unit 3's nuclear island. On the left-hand side, you can see some of the leveling concrete. On the right-hand side, you can see granite, which Fairfield County is known for. We did have an issue that delayed us in pouring the base mat. That issue is kind of pictorially demonstrated here. We had to increase the length of some of the vertical stabilizing bars, which provide shear strength. What that meant is we went from about 18 inches to 24 inches, so we had to shorten up a couple of areas. And the areas outlined in red are the areas of the base mat that were impacted by this. So it was two elevator shafts and one sump. So those changes were completed. We did have to submit a license amendment request to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in order to get these accomplished, which we have received. And obviously, we poured the base mat. I said we'd talk a little bit more about the containment vessel. This is the Sanmen Units 1 and 2 in China. And what's circled there is the Sanmen Unit 1 containment vessel. And you can see it just looks like a large steel can. So it's about 1¾-inch thick steel, relatively large volume, and it's made in a number of sections. So there's a lower bowl here called the bottom head. Then you've got three ring sections and then a top head. And if you look more closely at each of the ring sections, you can see there's a number of courses of steel in each ring section. So ring one and ring two have four courses of steel. Ring three has three courses. And this is from our site. You can see bottom left is that lower bowl assembly or lower head. Near the top left, you can see the first course of the first ring, including a couple of circular openings. Those are the equipment hatch and the personnel hatch. Top right, you can see all four courses of steel for ring one. And on the bottom right, you can see the bottom head. You can see the ring one, and between the two, you can see they're just started on ring two. This is the turbine island side. You can see we're well vertical on the turbine island side. Our cooling towers are not going to be the big 500-foot-tall hyperbolic natural draft cooling towers. We're going to opt for the roughly 60-foot-tall forced draft mechanical cooling towers. And this is them being erected here. That's one of the fan blades for the cooling towers. So we've got two of these fan blades installed now. This is the condenser section. It just condenses steam. We're putting it together outside of the excavation, and then we'll use the big derrick to lower it into the excavation when it's time. This is our simulator. It's a digital world now, much different than the simulators we used in the old generation of reactors, so everything is mouse-driven. A couple of equipment shots. This is reactor upper head package. So the closure head has control rod drive mechanisms that penetrate it. Those are supported by this integrated head package. This is being fabricated in Idaho. Doosan is in South Korea, and they're manufacturing the reactor vessel, and that vessel is ready to ship, and the steam generators. And you can see the two Alpha and two Bravo steam generators pictured here. Mangiarati in Italy is fabricating a number of tanks for us. And then the parent company for Westinghouse did get the bid for the turbine condenser and auxiliaries. And you can see the Unit 2 turbine in various stages of manufacture here. And a little bit about cost. We had petitioned to the South Carolina Public Service Commission back in 2008, and they issued us an order in 2009. For a total cost of about $6.313 billion. Our current estimate is about $5.698 billion. So you can see that we're about $600 million below what the original estimate was. And that is largely because of the current economy. So the workforce has been plentiful, and escalation rates have been very low. So we're fortunate that we're building in a time of very low inflation. much, much lower than we had anticipated. And then the debt financing costs are coming back a little lower than we had anticipated. That's it for me.
Questions?
Where do you stand in relation to Vogel as far as the building?
Where do we stand in relation to Vogel?
Ahead still or behind or even?
We got to one milestone ahead of them, but I wouldn't put too much stock in that. I think that what I think you're going to see is the projects are going to kind of be back and forth as to who's ahead and who's behind. We work hand in glove with the folks from Southern Company, and who deals with an issue like a regulatory issue depends on who gets there first, and that project will then slow down a little bit as they deal with it. But we lend each other support in dealing with those. So I anticipate that both these projects are going to complete about the same time.
Well, working together, I think, is a very good thing.
Yeah. Other questions? I have several. Do you assemble you put the bowl in and then you put the ring on top and then the ring on top and the ring on top, or do you assemble the whole thing and then lift the whole thing into the?
Too big, too heavy to do the whole thing.
That's what I
thought, yeah. So we'll lift them one piece at a time.
So
lower bowl goes in first.
Yeah.
Right. The ring sections go in one at a time. So it's three ring sections, and then the top closure head once all the components are inside.
All right. How many? What's your workforce? What is the construction workforce at this point?
Currently around 1,500. We think that we're going to peak a little over 3,000.
Okay. And then, Mike, are you? I know that in the past we've had the Chinese over here training them in various and things. Are you still doing that?
We haven't done any of the training sessions with the Chinese since about 2010, I believe.
So we
still have some visits. They open up their projects to us, so we've made a number of visits over there, but we're not doing the training any longer.
And this, I'm just curious, how do you, what qualifies you to be a reactor operator? Who are you picking? Who, when people come and apply for you, who you say, this guy's going to do it and this one isn't?
In general, historically, our industry has taken reactor operators from the nuclear Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, they would have been reactor operators in the Navy. So the Navy goes through a selection process. Otherwise, you get hired on as an auxiliary operator. You work your way through the ranks. It will take probably 4, 5, 6 years before you'd be fully qualified as an auxiliary operator. And then we go through a selection process to decide who would be successful candidates to go up for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission license. So we don't license them. The commission issues the license. We are responsible for training them. The training process will be a year plus to get the reactor operator's license. That license authorizes you to manipulate the controls of a nuclear reactor. And then you have to be a reactor operator for some period of time. We'll go through another selection process to get the senior reactor operator. That authorizes you to direct the controls of a nuclear reactor. And again, that's a year plus process, culminating in a three-pronged exam. There's a written exam, a simulator exam, and then a walkthrough where you demonstrate that you can do job performance measures.
And are they licensed for Unit 2 or VC Summer or AP 1000?
They will be licensed, since we're building identical plants,
right.
Our operators will be licensed for Units 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
The Unit 1 license is specific.
Right.
So we can't swap operators back and forth. We have to have some experience in the control room on day one, so we'll be taking operators from our existing unit, and we will be training them on the new units.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Our next speaker is Dr. Arjun Makajani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and he's going to talk about reprocessing spent fuel.
Chairman Pedersen, members of the council, thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation. And I should have said council. Sorry, I said committee. I only knew the acronym when I was making up the slides. Let's see. I'm not going to read this. I wrote a lot of fine print for the record, so you would have it. I just want to give you an overview that, you know, we had a spectacular failure of spent fuel management on the part of federal government. Ratepayers lost, utilities lost, the public lost, everybody lost. And I think part of that is because of haste. I don't think we should repeat that mistake. I think consolidated storage and reprocessing early on decisions would repeat that mistake. I want to tell you a little bit about France. I have quite a bit of experience in studying the French system. I know French. I've read their literature. I've discussed this issue in French, in France, led two teams of geologists. I'm not a geologist, but I did put together teams of geologists to look at their repository program, which has many impressive aspects, but there's much mythology about France in this country, and I'd like to set it straight. I've said some of these same things in front of the CEO of Areva, by the way, so I'm not saying anything that is out of the norm in terms of what you might find in their annual reports and other official documents. And I think we should follow some very elementary things that came out of the Blue Ribbon Commission in terms of the process of next steps of spent fuel management if we really want to succeed the next time in the long term rather than short term. So why did we fail in the past? This is common knowledge here, possibly, but the 1986 second site was canceled for political reasons. People from New Hampshire went to the White House and met Mr. Bush's assistant at the time, and you can imagine the implications of that. A few weeks later, the second site search was canceled. A year later, the search was narrowed to Yucca Mountain. And the thing I want to stress is Yucca Mountain was sold as a technically superior solution. When ultimately it came down to it, and you looked at the performance of the rock, according to contractor and DOE calculations, not mine, the rock was doing almost nothing for containment. It was all on the container. The rules were changed twice. I was on the EPA committee that looked at whether Yucca Mountain might meet all the EPA regulations for repository, which already promulgated in 1989. And we concluded that maybe Yucca Mountain wouldn't meet the carbon 14 standard. This was a consensus report. There were people from the national laboratories, there were people from the industry, there were people from EPRI. Anyway, it was a pretty broad expert committee. And we also concluded that maybe there were other sites that could meet this criterion. The NRC changed its rules. I call this procedure the double standard. So if you find a site isn't going to meet your rules, you don't change the rules. You find a better site. So the whole politicized nature of the process without consent led to a crashing failure, I think, in my opinion. Antithesis of science-based, in my view. And also led to the idea that the DOE should not be really centrally part of this. DOE is a waste generator and promoter of nuclear energy, and there should be an agency devoted to nuclear waste. That is the case in France, where they set up a separate agency. I believe it's also the case in Sweden, where they have, probably in my opinion, the most successful program. And I don't oppose a geologic repository, by the way. I think we need a repository program, and we should have a good science-based one. So the items before you on this spent fuel are consolidated storage and reprocessing. And I think to say that consolidated storage and reprocessing would bring jobs and economic development to this area is an exception. You have federal money coming in here or some outside money coming in here. Some number of jobs will be created. And I'm not an expert in the area to tell you how many jobs will be created or not. I don't think very many in consolidated storage, probably more in reprocessing. But I think of an out-of-order decision on consolidated storage and reprocessing would completely undermine the central ideas that were put forth by the Blue Ribbon Commission. A new agency, rules for disposal ahead of time, safety standards that would be generic, and the DOE out of the process. We don't have any of that. This DOE report that was presented was because Congress hasn't acted on any of the recommendations yet. In my opinion, a new agency should be created first. If you have a consolidated storage here, you'd have packaging, you'd have transportation. Independently of whatever you may think about reprocessing on nuclear power, I think the most likely outcome is you're going to have a piling up of spent fuel here with no exit in view. Then now you have the DOE spending money on consolidated storage, and you create a new agency. You have two agencies in conflict over the same pile of money. This would not be a very good thing. It would be a bureaucratic and fiscal and accountability mess, in my opinion. So I think the first thing to do is to create a new agency that is transparent and accountable, and to create a set of standards that are generic for the whole process of spent fuel management, whether it is interim storage or long-term disposal. Interim storage, as you know, the licensing of all reactors is now suspended because the courts avoided the waste confidence rule of the NRC, and the NRC itself has said there are a lot of things on interim storage in terms of very long-term storage, in terms of deterioration of spent fuel, that we don't know. And one of their documents actually says if we have spent fuel transfer from one cask to another and we find damaged spent fuel, we'll figure out at that time how to do it because we know how to detect damage. Not that we know how to handle the problem, but we know how to detect the damage and we can quickly put back the spent fuel and then take some time to figure it out. Not very reassuring to me, at least. Let me tell you a little bit about France. 1973, France had, could you give me a 5-minute warning? So I ran. 5 minutes before 20 minutes, because you want 10 minutes for Q&A, and I really think that probably is the most important thing. So in 15 minutes after I began, so I think 10 minutes from now. The French had a bigger problem in 1973 than the United States in terms of energy, because not only did they have transportation and industry dependent on oil, they had a large part of their electricity generation dependent on oil. And unlike now, where you can say, according to the Energy Information Administration, wind energy is cheaper than new nuclear. That's the latest data they've published. Whether you agree with it or not, that's sort of more or less the ballpark. At the time, that certainly wasn't the case. So they decided they were going to go nuclear, and they decided that they were going to go breeder reactors and reprocessing. So they were going to close the fuel cycle. They had stopped or nearly stopped their uranium mining. So this was a decision that made a lot of sense to them from their energy policy point of view. And as you know, they completed this transition in 25 years. It was a very remarkable technical accomplishment, whatever you think of, you know, the positive or negative merits of the particular technology they chose. But one piece of it did not work. The breeder reactor piece, which was central to closing, did not work in the sense of commercialization. So they built the Phoenix. It worked pretty well. Then they built Super Phoenix, which was the demonstration, the biggest breeder reactor that has ever been built. And Super Phoenix operated for 14 years with a 7% capacity factor overall. And the problem hasn't been the reactor so much, in my judgment. The problem has been the handling of sodium is much, much more difficult, complicated, and once you have a leak, much different than water. Worldwide, about $100 billion have been spent on the effort to in sort of recent dollars to commercialize the sodium-cooled breeder reactor. $100 billion with a B. Not successful. The most recent large demonstration reactors have operated worse than some of the earlier ones, so there's no demonstrable learning curve. Manju operated just for a very brief time in Japan, and it is still shut, 15 years shut, briefly restarted, again shut. I don't think it generated a significant amount of power, much less than 1% capacity factor. And even if they work, they're more expensive than light water reactors. In the late 80s, the French faced a decision. It was clear that they weren't going to have a breeder reactor system, but they had a functioning reprocessing plant